primer for that paper. Sort of, I think it'll help to understand what the paper is trying to do and how it's doing it before you actually get in there and try and read our definitions and proofs and stuff. So why do we want to test? Well, for one, suppose you want to buy a component for a BB84 quantum cryptography system. Right? So you want to buy a source for your QKD apparatus. Right? And this source has to have an input where you know, the first bit, for example, is which basis you're going to use, and the second bit is which bit you want to encode. So if you input 00, or your computer input 00, you should output ket 0, 01, you output 1 in the standard basis. You know, and if you put 10, this is saying the plus minus basis, and output a 0 on that basis, and so on. Right? You get four states with these very specific inter-product relations. Right? But why should you trust this component? Somebody, you know, Idékantik or Magic or anyone else tries to sell this to you, why should you believe that that's what's being output? Right. So, well, why shouldn't you anyway? Right? If it seems to have the right statistics, what else, you know, what else could be going on? Well, for example, what could be going on is, you know, it does output a zero, but in some other degree of freedom, it also outputs a zero, and it does output a one, but there's another bit of information or two bits of information, and it does output 0 plus 1 in those degrees of freedom, but it outputs 2 and so on and 3. So it outputs actually 4 orthogonal states, right, with this information in another degree of freedom or a side channel, right? And if you've heard, you know, Gilles Brassard's, one of his talks on, you know, the history of quantum crypto and the first implementation, he was saying, you know, that it was perfectly secure as long as you were deaf, because you could actually hear which basis, there was some sort of sound that was made depending on which basis you were using. Or every time you changed the basis, there was a click or something. Right? So that's a side channel. Now, I think we can fairly easily rule out, you know, sound as, you know, sound side channels. But other side channels such as timing, frequency, or whatever else, position, right? Because sometimes you take one of two paths. If you follow this path, you're in one basis. You're in this path, you're in another basis. And then you get recombined into the same beam and sent out the same hole. And you know, you're supposed to be in exactly the same position, or at least the wave, you know, the position wave packet should be pretty darn indistinguishable, right? And the timing wave packet and so on. Those are the kind of side channels which would naturally, very naturally occur inadvertently. And maybe it works fine when you buy it, but then there could be a failure mode later on as your apparatus starts to erode, as your temperature changes in the system, then maybe, you know, one fiber becomes longer than the other or something. So these are realistic problems that could happen. So we need to make sure that our assumptions and our testing procedures, well, we need to make them explicit. And we also would prefer not to rely on some other untrusted apparatus, right? Because people would often say, well, I know that's what it does because I did a tomography of the system. But you did a tomography with some other apparatus, right? And how do you know that your apparatus is doing whatever operations you think they're doing? Right? You're not really solving the problem. So that's why we want sort of the self and self-testing, because ultimately your whole laboratory or all of our scientific knowledge in some sense is a self-test. So I think Michael mentioned this yesterday. Myers and Yao were the first, to my knowledge, to develop a self-test for the purposes of QKD. They were just self-testing sources. So they had, you know, if you had a black box that allegedly outputted EPR pairs, and if it satisfied, you know, the EPR statistics, so there's each party could pick one of three projective measurements to perform. And if they got the right statistics, then they were, so if the statistics were consistent with an EPR pair, then they were sure that they were locally unitarily equivalent to an EPR pair. So what that means is that this box is outputting some state, which up to a local unitary, one on Alice and one on Bob's side, gave you an EPR pair shared between Alice and Bob, tensor product other junk, And this other junk could be entangled. It could be many other EPR pairs. Could be lots of other stuff. But you at least had in there an EPR pair. So why is this useful? So you know that the state you get is up to local unitaries in EPR pair, tensor, other junk. So if Bob, you know, if at this arm, and this could all be in your own lab, of course, you do a measurement with respect to the zero, you know, the 0-1 basis. You know, you get zero. Well, you know that up to this local unitary, the other half of your apparatus, which you assume is isolated from this half, you have a zero tensor sum rho A. And if you saw a 1, you have a 1 tensor the same rho A, up to a local basis change. And if you get a plus, you have a plus tensor rho A and a minus tensor rho A. There's no opportunity for a side channel, at least not an inadvertent one. You'd really have to have the information from here somehow traveling to the other side of your apparatus. But you can't accidentally, because you're a bit incompetent or imperfect in realigning your beams, accidentally leak side channel information. So this is, you know, a very reliable source of BB84 states, if you want to do prepare and send. You could, of course, just use this for traditional EPR-based crypto. So the main assumptions, so there's always some assumptions. Their main assumptions are locality, in that, you know, the measurements at one, at Alice's end, commute with the measurements at Bob end. There's no signaling from one system to the other. And also, as is typical in science, you can repeat this experiment many times, right? So they're assuming they're getting identically prepared, you know, states. Now, one drawback was the results weren't shown to be robust. They just proved that if you exactly satisfy those statistics, then you exactly have an EPR pair, right? So of course, any realistic application will need to be robust, because we can only really accumulate statistics and be confident that, you know, within some epsilon or within delta of an actual of those actual statistics. I should mention Reinhard Werner pointed out to me that he thinks there's some related earlier work on CH-SH inequalities, but I haven't followed that up. That sort of has some robustness in there as well, so there might be some related literature there. But assuming robustness, this might, I think, be the only way, using only these assumptions, to securely prepare BB84 states for QKD. If you want to be this paranoid, if you don't want to make any additional assumptions, I mean, I might be wrong, but I suspect that this is, you know, prepare an EPR state, test that, and just send one half is the only way I can think of. Of course, companies that do QKD don't like this, because this isn't how they do it. This is hugely impractical for getting high bit rates at present, so they don't really, they're not too excited about doing this, because we can't really do this in the short term. But if you want your security, your physical security assumptions to be this strict, I suspect this is the only way to do it. Okay, why else would we want to test? Well, suppose we're paying a lot of money to perform a large quantum computation, right? Because the first quantum computers, well, there won't be many of them. You know, and like the guy said, who was it? Watson will only need a handful, 6 or so, forever. Anyway, so there won't be many of them in the beginning, at least. And you won't. Suppose you're solving a problem whose answer is not efficiently classically checkable, right? If you're solving an NP complete problem, then it's not a big deal. But otherwise, how do you know? Yeah. Or, you know, why should you trust the result? Or, you know, suppose you proved the clay, you know, you proved that P doesn't equal NP, right? And your proof is a classical proof with a description of a quantum circuit with the property that if this circuit correctly run outputs a 1, you know, P equals NP, and if it outputs 0, P doesn't equal NP. And you can check the classical part. The only thing that remains is to actually run the quantum computer. And not everyone in the world has a quantum computer, so you can't just say, well, you know, surely there isn't this global conspiracy. So how do you know that they've correctly run that quantum computation and the answer is actually correct? You know, or should they pay us $1 million, basically? Okay, well, what else was known about testing? I've mentioned the Myers-Yao. There's a lot of literature on classical testing, which I'm not reviewing here, but we review in the paper. But in terms of quantum self-testing, there's a paper by Wim Van Dam, Fred Magnez, and Miklos, which was a series of self-tests for a universal and fault-tolerant set of gates. But we had three additional assumptions. We assumed we could use the same gate in the same experiment. So we had some mystery gate, but I could actually apply it twice in the same experiment. Not feasible in some implementations, that's a reasonable thing. You know, like an NMR, you just, you know, apply the same pulse sequence again. But in optics, you can't really grab a mirror and move it to later on in your computation and expect it to be, you know, expect to do that. We also assumed you could prepare and measure zeros and ones. I don't think these two were big assumptions. These, I think, could fairly easily be removed. Our biggest assumption is we assumed we knew the dimension of the systems. Right? We assumed our qubits were really living in a two-dimensional Hilbert space, period, which limits the conspiracies. The alternative explanations are limited if you have to do it all within a two-dimensional Hilbert space. And in reality, there's no two-dimensional Hilbert spaces. You know, if you have a photon in one of two paths, there's, like I said, position is essentially a continuous Hilbert space, and timing and frequency. I mean, you never really get a perfect 2D system. You get an effective one, but if you want to be paranoid, there's a lot of room to stash information. So what needed to be done? Well, we would have liked to remove those three assumptions. Again, three and four I don't think were a big deal, but five is non-trivial. And we'd like it to be composable, so we could self-test a large circuit and still be efficient. Because we want to be able to test a large circuit by just testing all the parts and then gluing together those parts. Because if we had to test an n-qubit circuit, we have to do exponential and n tests, unless we think we can decompose it. So one step in that direction. So, and our technique is essentially to combine these EPR tests of Myers-Yao with our style of gate testing. So suppose you have an EPR source which you've tested according to Myers and Yao, and then you want to test a gate G. Right? So you prepare EPR states, you measure in a random basis here, apply G and measure. So effectively, you're doing, you know, an overcomplete set of inputs, seeing the outputs. You're doing a tomography of G here. So whatever the tomography tells you, if the tomography is consistent with G, then you do have G. You have G restricted to the Hilbert space, the support, basically the Hilbert space spanned by the inputs consistent with these measurements, right? Because G, of course, we want to know what it does on this qubit that we've defined. It could be doing all sorts of other things. You know, if I move my beam over slightly to the left, to a region I've never tested before, I don't know what G is going to do. So we can't fully characterize this G. We're implicitly only characterizing it on what it does on inputs of this form, created by preparing an EPR state and measuring half of it. That's an important concept for our testing. But this is not composable. So suppose I've characterized G, I do some more experiments and characterize some other gate H, and now I want to do a circuit that applies G and then H. There's no reason to expect that H is going to behave the same here on these inputs coming in than it did on the outputs of that EPR box, right? Because photons or whatever that go through this G black box, this G gate, could be in a totally different Hilbert space, totally orthogonal Hilbert space, than photons that came out of this EPR box. Right? Because every time a qubit goes through, or any information goes through a gate G, it could have attached to it a classical transcript of what's happened to it. Right? So, which means it's in an orthogonal Hilbert space. So this system, this kind of trivial composition doesn't work. it worked in our original work because we assumed, you know, there was one two-dimensional Hilbert space, and that was it. So the output of G, you know, had to be the same input of H as when we had the EPR states, because H only took in that one two-dimensional Hilbert space as input. But that's not a realistic assumption in most cases. Well, I mean, spatially local. Yeah. Well, it's effectively two-dimensional, according to that theorem by Myers and Yao. Where was I? So we want to test the performance of an entire circuit, right? So here's a circuit. This is the actual physical gates, and we want to know that it's really implementing at least approximately some ideal circuit that, you know, the computer scientists have designed for us. So before I give you the test, another major challenge we were confronted with is that our original self-testing paper had a finite set of tests. You pass this finite set of tests, and with those additional assumptions, you could extrapolate to any circuit that used those gates. But with this more paranoid set of assumptions, you can't do that. You can't have some finite set of tests and some standard do these tests and then know that these gates will work in any circuit. That won't work unless you have additional assumptions. The reason is kind of straightforward. If there were some finite set of tests, note that the gates can always pass on, can always tack on a little post-it note, which send it, do what it's supposed to do, but add a little post-it note that says, okay, this is what I did. So at the present time, each input qubit has with it its full history. Right? So what each gate does is, it says, well, if the input state, it'll look at the full history of its input qubits, it'll look at what it's being asked to do, and it'll say, is this part of a test, right? It'll look up the standards for the testing and say, yes, this could be part of a test. So then it'll do what it's supposed to do and just pass on another post-it note with the description of what's happened. As soon as the gate sees, hey, this is not a test, then it can do whatever it likes. It can output random bits. It can do whatever it likes because it's not part of a test anymore. It's you doing a real computation. So it's easy to spoof a test if the set of tests is predefined and finite. So it suggests that if you want to do testing, you should make sure every circuit could be a test, right? Because if every circuit could be a test, then you're going to have to be on your best behavior all of the time, or most of the time, or you're likely to be caught. So suppose we want to run this circuit here. This is how we would do it. So we'd prepare our two inputs, but they would be halves of EPR pairs, right? And we do the Myers-Yao test for the EPR pairs, so verify the initial sources. We would do tomographies of the gates G1, G2. Then on the other branch, we would sort of uncompute G1 and G2, right? Do what should be their inverses, right? And if this indeed is their inverse, then it's not too hard to check that we should be getting back EPR pairs again, right? These, if you do G on one side and G dagger on the other, you're going to get, with an EPR pair as an input, you're going to get back an EPR pair. Perhaps in a different Hilbert space, but we don't mind. So you redo the Myers-Yao test to make sure indeed you do have two EPR states, and then you run G3 here. So the key thing is you're not testing G3's behavior on these Hilbert spaces. You're testing it on the Hilbert space, which is sort of the relevant one, which is output, where the relevant information is being output from G1 and G2. So you're testing its behavior in its proper context. And you do a tomography, and then you can continue with this other test and so on. Right? Now there's one last technical glitch. So in some sense, what's going on is we're doing a series of tomographies to make sure that the gates are doing the right thing. And by uncomputing and retesting it, that you have an EPR pair, it kind of guarantees that there isn't information being coupled to some, you know, in other degrees of freedom. Because if there were, you wouldn't get back EPR pairs. One last technical glitch is that, right, you know, these EPR pairs will all put random bits, right, and I have an N qubit circuit. What's the chance I'm going to get the all zero string? Pretty low. So we kind of want to be able to, if we want to do computation, prepare a definite input state. So one way to do it is to prepare EPR states, measure. If you get a 1, then flip, do an X gate, do a NOT gate. Right? Kind of the obvious thing. And to some extent, this is how all or most physical apparatuses prepare a 0. They prepare their qubit, they measure it. If it's 0, they're happy. If it's 1, they flip it to 0. Right? This is sort of how all these, or most, preparations actually work if you think of them computationally. Not necessarily all, but I mean, this is a fairly natural thing to do, let's say. Okay. So when you want to run this computation, what you do is you prepare your inputs by this procedure. We assume that classical, we're going to assume, this is another important assumption, that the classical computation is trusted. Okay? You might not be happy with that, but we're assuming that classical computation is trusted. And then you go and you test this circuit. Okay, so we're assuming that this gate doesn't know why it's there. It doesn't know that it was controlled by a bit. They're just being told to run, and they're doing their job. And then you test that circuit by the standard procedure. And the important thing is that, you know, this gate here, or this gate at no point, because time's running upwards, does it know if it's part of the, like, there's no way for this G1 to know it, while it's running in this computation, whether it's part of a test, whether it's part of, you know, of a conspiracy test, whether it's part of a tomography test, or whether it's part of the actual computation. It doesn't know. So it more or less has to behave or get detected with some probability. Okay. So that's basically the gist of our self-testing of quantum circuits. There's a lot of technical details in the paper, but this is the gist of it. If you do wish to attempt to read through the paper and you understand this, then I think that'll make the details a lot more natural. Let me tell you some of the technical details of how we achieve this. One thing, actually, I don't have a slide on it, is we define this virtual qubit because, you know, we have to somehow find a qubit in this Hilbert space. The technical trick that, well, I think Myers and Yao came up with it was in their paper, was to add this virtual qubit. So when they do this unitary equivalence, they add a virtual qubit and kind of push the qubit you want into this one extra virtual qubit. But I think there's other ways to do it, but that's how we do it in that paper. But it's just a technicality. An important point to make is that this procedure, we only proved it works, and I think it only works for gates and states with real coefficients. Okay. Now let me clarify that I'm not assuming that everything's real. You know, I'm aware of the complex universe, or at least assuming that there's the possibility of complex amplitudes. But, you know, if you come to me and say, please verify this circuit with complex states and gates, I would say, I don't know, I'm not in the business of doing that. I'll only do it for real coefficients, which is not a big deal because there's recipes. So if you want to factor a large number using Shor's algorithm, you know, you're going to panic because, oh my God, that has complex gates in it. Don't worry, because there's a standard recipe that translates it into a real circuit with real inputs, with real coefficients. So we're not losing any power, but there is this doubling, or not necessarily doubling, but some increase, actually one extra qubit. Right, so we're just saying, I don't have a test that'll work, at least right now, I don't have a test that'll work in the non-real case. And it's not because we didn't try or we didn't care. It's just there's actually an important reason why we didn't do it. And as I said, one complex bit can be simulated by two real bits in a fairly natural way. I mean, it was written up in this paper. I'm not sure if it was written up anywhere else, but the two systems are not equivalent with respect to our notion of equivalence. Our notion of equivalence is this local unitary equivalence, which is nice because it kind of preserves inner products, right? But this equivalence does not preserve inner products, right? So if your adversary is really selling you real equipment, or you know, is pretending to sell you this complex equipment, but in reality is doing the real operations, right? But your measurements are not giving you all the information they could. They're just simulating the complex, these alleged complex Hilbert spaces. But these states might be more orthogonal than the complex description says they are. They could be totally orthogonal, for example. But in the complex description, they're not. So certainly for cryptographic purposes, this is a very you want the equivalence to preserve inner products. But the simulation of a complex by reals does not preserve inner products. So it's bad. So it's not at all clear how to actually test a complex bit and a complex gate, because there's a conspiracy, a bad conspiracy. So in our paper, the way we prove all these results is to define two notions, one of simulation, right? And simulation is essentially all about producing the right probabilities, right? If you produce the right probabilities, you're simulating that circuit. But also of equivalence. And equivalence means there's this local unitary equivalence, because you can simulate without being equivalent, as we said. But under the conditions outlined in my talk, in this paper, simulation does imply equivalence. So I'm just sort of laying out the structure of the proof. Okay. So let me actually state a theorem. So again, there's the folklore is that for every equation, you lose half your audience. So I saved my equations for the very end. So let T1 up to T to the T be some unitary, n qubit unitaries, typically, you know, acting non-trivially only on one or two gates, only on one or two qubits. So these are, you know, one or two qubit gates doing allegedly doing identity on everything else. They are doing identity on everything else. And some input n-bit string x and some parameters epsilon and gamma. If the test we outline, which is essentially that series of tests that I described earlier, with input x and parameters epsilon and gamma, if we say it passes the test, what it means is that with probability 1 minus big O of gamma, the outcome probability distribution will be, you know, epsilon to the 1 over 8 times t plus n. Again, t is the number of gates, n is the number of qubits, within the correct probability distribution. Right? So you have to make epsilon to the 1 over 8 smaller than the inverse of 1 over t plus n. And so most importantly, how much work had to be done? How many experiments did you have to do? Well, the number of experiments is linear in the number of gates and almost linear in the number of qubits, linear in 1 over epsilon and in the log of 1 over lambda. Well, it should be gamma, sorry. Getting my Greek letters confused. Right. So it's efficient in the computer science sense of the word, right? Though epsilon to the 1 over 8 is not a very pleasant polynomial if you're an experimentalist, right? Because you're saying if I want, you know, roughly speaking, 2 bits of precision, I have to get 16 bits of experimental accuracy, very loose, again, ignoring the constants. But that's not a lot of fun to do 8 times, well, exponential, like to have to get, you know, 8n bits of precision in order to be able to make a statement about the first n bit, the high order n bits of your gates. It requires a lot of experimental precision. So that leads me to the first open problem. That is the first open problem. Apply these to get to actual experiments. Actually, that's the second one. Can we improve the asymptotics? I'm not sure. It'd be nice if we could, because it would make them a little more practical. And applying them to actual experiments, again, we might have to modify some of the assumptions. We could maybe add more assumptions which are more plausible in one implementation than in others. For example, in optics, I'm very happy to buy the locality assumption. Right? But in NMR, I'm not really so happy, because the RF pulses are irradiating the whole sample and not just the one qubit. I guess that's my third point. No, it's not. So QKD, so as I mentioned before, I think that if you're really paranoid, the only prepare and send type schemes that I would trust are prepare an EPR pair and measure half of it in a random basis. Right? Because you don't have the opportunity to encode information in side channels. That's not very practical. Can we do something a little easier and still testable and still believable by looking at, but we'd have to look at the details of a particular implementation and have, you know, add additional assumptions, but one that we're really willing to believe. And then maybe still have, you know, a prepare and send type QKD. I don't know if that's possible, but it would be nice if it were possible. And can something be done about the complex case? Because the conspiracy I told you about has the property that it's not local, right? So when you know, two simulating one is fine, but then you need n plus one real bits to simulate n complex bits. But there's one bit that has to kind of be everywhere, right? But physically it has to be somewhere. And so it's a non-local conspiracy, but if we are assuming locality, so there might be one of two things will happen. We either come up with a local conspiracy, or we come up with a test that maybe will let us do something about complex gates as well. Thanks to our many sponsors, and thanks to you. Short intuition.
So if the exponent were one half, I would say, you want to estimate the probability, you flip the coin, you want to estimate the probability of it coming up head, you have to, your accuracy is going to be, one in square root of n with n test. So I was wondering if there was some similar intuition for where this 1/8.
There might be, but I can't give it to you. I don't know it right now. There's an epsilon to the 1/4 somewhere in the guts, because we use various theorems that I don't understand from on semi-algebras and whatever. No, we didn't. I think Fred tested them, and so there's an epsilon to the 1/4 kicking around, and then at some point it becomes an epsilon to the 1/8 in the final theorem. So you can, there's the 1/2 that maybe we can easily develop an intuition for. But the initial 1/4, I don't know.
Do you have any lower bounds on how the contribution scales?
So I don't. Can I come up with any instantly? Probably not. I don't have any non-trivial ones.
What are the trivial ones?
So. And qubits. I would guess it's probably, omega t, omega n, but even that I can't off the top of my head give you a proof for. And in the epsilons and gammas, I don't. I'd have to think about it. But. No, so this is sort of, I guess, a corollary of some other, theorem, which actually talks about the states. So there's this equivalence of the actual states, and this is a sort of a corollary of that. So there should be, we stated it in terms of this variation distance, but I think there should be a similar result on how close the output state is to what it should be.
So the output state would be defined only if the input is given. So when we only talk about verifying a circuit, then
yeah.
Sort of
oh, I see. So what's the question?
So suppose we are given a black box, which is supposed to, maybe, it's a group of things. So I mean, so basically there is some other way in which description is like,